we went out Christmas shopping last night, and the wife and I sat and talked, and I said, well, we can do, you know, we're going to have to pay the water bill because we have to have water and the electric bill. So we decided we're going to have to not pay for the car this month if we're going to have Christmas.
That was not the only hard decision Stephen Jenkins had to make this year. Stephen used to work an assembly line job in Springfield, Ohio. He was laid off in January. He's 65, so he collected unemployment and tapped into Social Security. But it wasn't enough. In March, his landlord filed to evict Stephen and his family.
When I first got laid off, I thought, hey, I could just find another job, take that step, find another house, take that step. But with the pandemic, it slammed the door on both of those.
Stephen tried to fight the eviction. He spent his savings on legal fees. Ultimately, he had to try to find a new place to live in the middle of the pandemic.
Every place I called to find if the rentals were open, we were turned down. They said they're not renting because of the pandemic. There was no properties coming open here in Springfield. And then the simple fact that they ask you in the credit applications when you try to find a rental property, have you ever been asked to move? I could not lie, and because I tell them that, they were turned down.
So Stephen has been turned down for housing. He's also been turned down for jobs. He's still looking. Just last week, though, he went to 3 different interviews.
From finding out that when you're 65 years old, and I have over 30 years maintenance experience, you're not a hot item for a lot of companies. I'm finding out that you may be qualified, but when you go in for the first interview and they see and figure out that you're 60 plus years old, most of them don't want you.
In November, Stephen contracted the coronavirus. He has recovered. But you know what Stephen says has had the biggest impact on his well-being? It's that looming eviction.
Basically, I wake up at 3 or 4 o'clock every morning wondering when we're going to be put in the street. And it's taken its toll on my health. I've had to go see a heart doctor, and they attribute all this stress and stuff to the aneurysm I now have. And it has affected me psychologically. It pushes a sane man into a corner, and it puts thoughts there that shouldn't be there. And I'm not suicidal, I'm not saying that, but it gets very scary.
So hey, everyone, just keep listening, because this is happening to people all across the country. At the end of September, Stephen was told that he no longer qualifies for those expanded unemployment benefits. He and his family are trying to get by on regular unemployment insurance, which is $337 per week, plus that Social Security he's still collecting. Well, this week, after months of inaction in the Senate, Congress finally passed a relief bill. It includes increased unemployment benefits and $600 stimulus checks for qualifying Americans.
And that's encouraging. I'm not trying to be hard-nosed about this, but I'd love to walk onto the Senate floor in front of all those congressmen and look them in the eye and ask them if they could live on $300 a week. It's impossible. And then the $600 stimulus, it's not even going to help people pay this month's rent, let alone what we're behind in.
That's Stephen Jenkins in Springfield, Ohio. From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. And I do wonder if any elected official from Ohio is listening to this. Maybe you want to take up Stephen on his offer. Invite him into the halls of Congress, the floor of the House, the floor of the Senate. Let him ask that question. Could you live on $300 a week? Maybe do that instead of giving yourselves a hearty congratulations for, yes, finally doing something this week. But is it enough? You heard Stephen there saying unemployment and the pandemic has pushed his family into a financial hole. Nearly 8 million Americans were plunged into that same hole, were plunged into poverty since this summer. So what's caused that? Is it individual indolence? No. Is it the pandemic? Well, yes, in a manner of speaking. But as always, the pandemic is a mirror. And what it reflects back this time is a politics of indifference in the face of the suffering of millions. So today, we're going to talk about what that suffering is looking like right now. And James Sullivan joins us. He's an economics professor at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana, and he's co-created something called the COVID-19 Income and Poverty Dashboard. Professor Sullivan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Good to talk to you.
So give me a sense here. How fast has poverty in America grown in the second half of 2020?
Yeah, so if you look at poverty rates since June, we've seen an increase of 2.4 percentage points, and that's nearly 8 million new individuals added to the ranks of the poor. And if you compare that to a more historical perspective, that rise is larger than any one-year increase we've seen since we've started calculating poverty rates in the United States going back to the 1960s.
So in 60 years, essentially, you're saying,
yeah,
a couple of generations, we've never seen a one-year rise in poverty as fast as we've seen this year.
That's right. Now, the rise is over the last 6 months. Prior to that, we were seeing poverty rates declining. But on net, we're at a higher rate today than we were prior to the pandemic.
Okay, so for true historical perspective, let's underscore what you just said. In comparison to, say, the 30s, right, we still have an overall lower poverty rate than America's overall historical poverty levels.
That's right. I mean, if you take a really long view, we don't quite have official statistics going that far back, but we do have it going back to the early 1960s. The story is much more positive. We've made a lot of progress in terms of reducing poverty and deep deprivation. And even if you take a shorter view, say, let's say since 2010, where we saw poverty rates near their peak as a result of the Great Recession, we've seen a sharp decline. So poverty rates were falling steadily between 2010 and the very beginning of 2020, but then the pandemic hit, and that's when things started to change dramatically.
Okay, so we see a lot of numbers floating around in the media, so help me understand what some of them mean. When we say that the poverty rate jumped to just under 12% in November, I see 11.7% here, what exactly does that mean?
So what we do is we compare the total income of a household. So that's their earnings and income they might get from cash income they might get from federal support to a poverty line. And there's nothing magical about this poverty line. But, you know, a long time ago, we set a line above which people are designated as not poor and below of which they're designated as poor. And so we compare their family income to that poverty line. If their income falls below that line, then they're classified as poor. And so that 11.7% just says that of all the individuals in the United States, 11.7% live in families with income that fall below their poverty line. So think about $25,000 for a family of four. And you know, that poverty line will differ based on family size.
We're talking about one in eight Americans, though, right? Roughly?
Yes, that's right. And you know, children are disproportionately represented, and obviously certain demographic groups are represented at a much higher rate.
So the thing is, though, that as you've been tracking it, the poverty levels in this country over the course of this year, I'm seeing here from your dashboard that every month from June of 2020 onwards, the poverty rate has steadily increased. When you saw that trend, Professor Sullivan, what was your first reaction? What were you thinking when you saw sort of the direction that trend line was going?
It actually, unfortunately, lined up with pretty much with what we expected, because we know one thing to note to put that in perspective is that early on in the pandemic, poverty rates were falling, and we can attribute that in large part to the initial relief package, the CARES Act, that supported family incomes during the early stages of the pandemic. And what we knew was going to happen was the expiration of these benefits. The stimulus payments were one time, and the supplemental unemployment insurance benefits expired at the end of July. And so without additional relief, it was a pretty safe bet to guess that poverty was going to rise. And that's what we've seen. The one factor that could have offset that would be a dramatic improvement in the labor market. And we were seeing that particularly over the summer. But those improvements have slowed dramatically. And there's actually more recent signs, like those applying for unemployment insurance, that suggest that we're regressing again. And so we haven't seen that dramatic improvement in the labor market. And as a result, poverty rates have risen.
So what you're saying is that because the economy overall is not rebounding the way we need it to yet, right, and that therefore there's no – those labor market improvements haven't happened as deeply as we need to. We have 8 million more Americans now who have been plunged into poverty pretty much because – the extended benefits from the federal government ran out and Congress could not come up with some other package until this week.
That's right. I mean, ultimately it's because the pandemic has taken a huge toll on the labor market in the United States. And there is no relief for those who are, bearing the toughest burden of this pandemic.
Well, Professor James Sullivan, stand by here. We are talking this hour about politics, pandemic, and poverty in America. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we are talking about politics, the pandemic, and poverty in America. And yes, we're talking about it this week as Congress has passed a $900 billion relief package for Americans. But we're getting a lot of comments from On Point listeners about how far that money might go in their lives in particular. For example, on Facebook, Annie Martin is telling us that $600 stimulus check that qualifying Americans are going to receive, Annie says it would just cover our electric bill, gas bill, internet connection with kids in school online, and a bit left over for the water bill. Wouldn't make a dent in anything else. Not the mortgage, food, trash, gas for the car. Yes, jobs exist, but for older people with various injuries, some of those places would not hire us, nor do they pay a living wage. So I want to take a second here, Professor Sullivan, to just remind folks sort of the political machinations that got us to this place right now, especially given the fact that you said that without the rebounding of the labor market, it's really the lapse in support from the federal government, which has pushed some 8 million Americans into poverty this year. So let's take a moment to listen back to some of the highlights, if I can call them, or lowlights in Washington that finally led to the passage of this week's package. So going way back, first of all, March 27th, when President Trump signed the $2.2 trillion CARES Act into law.
The single biggest economic relief package in American history, and I must say, or any other package, by the way.
So that was a huge bill, and it provided direct $1,200 payments to qualifying Americans and relief to struggling businesses, also expanded unemployment. But then in May, the House passed the $3 trillion Heroes Act, which included funding for struggling states. That bill died on Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's desk. Here's Mitch McConnell and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi in August.
But if Democrats are playing hardball, their opponents aren't us Republicans. Not really. They're playing hardball against kids, workers, and vulnerable Americans who need help.
Everything is left out. Our assistance to the schools, feeding the hungry, helping people who are going to be evicted.
In September, Democrats turned down a $500 billion Republican counteroffer, Republican relief bill. Again, leadership from both parties took aim at opposite sides.
Today, every senator will either say they want to send families the relief we can agree to, or they can send families nothing.
This bill is not going to happen because it is so emaciated, so filled with poison pills, so partisanly designed. It was designed to fail.
In October, the House passed a scaled-down $2.2 trillion Heroes 2.0 Act. Remember, the one they had passed earlier in the year was $3 trillion. Again, this pared-down bill was destined to go nowhere in the Senate, though pre-election negotiations continued when Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin put a $1.8 trillion offer on the table. But this offer lacked the level of state and municipal funding that Democrats were looking for. It also included reduced supplemental unemployment insurance. The Senate Majority Leader said another stimulus package would, quote, be unlikely in the next 3 weeks, meaning before the November election. The Senate did, however, manage to confirm a new Supreme Court justice. Well, November comes, the national election now behind them, and a Georgia Senate runoff in front of them. Republicans and Democrats came back to the table to pass that $900 billion package this week. Here's Senator McConnell and Speaker Pelosi yesterday.
None of us think any of this legislation is perfect, but a big bipartisan majority of us recognize the incredible amount of good it will do when we send it to the president's desk.
It doesn't go all the way, but it takes us down the path, a first step. So I have hope because of the virus, and I have hope because of the election of Joe Biden as president of the United States.
So, Professor Sullivan, that's sort of a little walkthrough this year politically. Let's talk about the bill here for a second that was just passed in Congress. How much is it likely to help the 8 million people that we were talking about earlier who have been pushed into poverty?
Well, I think initially it's going to help a tremendous amount. The short-term relief, you know, in 1 month, a family of four would be eligible for stimulus payments of $2,400, and then you, if they're receiving unemployment insurance, the $300 a week supplement will go a long ways. The real challenge, I think, is the uncertainty about how long this is going to last. Right. So if we knew that everything was going to bounce back in March, I think that this would be a much more positive step. The problem is that we don't know. And actually, the best guess is probably the challenges that the pandemic presents economically are going to extend well beyond March. And so what that does is create a lot of uncertainty. I was struck by Stephen Jenkins' comment about the prospects of being evicted, creating anxiety and affecting his health. I think that we're seeing a lot of that in the broader data. If you go back to the initial CARES Act that led to a sharp increase in income and a decrease in poverty, early on in the pandemic, what you saw was spending was falling sharply, even though incomes were going up. And what that reflected in part was that families were anxious about, you know, when this relief runs out, how will we put food on the table? You know, how will we?
Professor Sullivan, you still with us?
In March, if things will be moving in the right direction enough to say things are on track.
We just lost you for a couple of seconds there, but you were saying that a lot depends on how this country decides to move forward. But let me dig into some of the numbers a little bit more with you from your dashboard here. I'm seeing that you found you and your research partners have found that. In the last 6 months of 2020, poverty rose the most for Black Americans, right? Up more than 3%, or almost 1.5 million people. For Americans with high school degrees or less, up 5%, or around 5 million people. And these are the same groups of Americans who experienced the largest job losses due to the pandemic.
That's right. And that's in large part why these groups are taking the biggest toll, right? They tend to be represented in the industries that are hit hardest by the pandemic, which suggests that there's tremendous uncertainty for these vulnerable groups about when we're going to get back to economic stability, because there's still a lot of questions remain about, you know, when will the restaurant industry, the travel industry, and other leisure and entertainment that have been hit hardest by the recession, when are they going to, and the pandemic, when are they going to be able to bounce back? And unfortunately, it's the groups that were struggling to make ends meet the most prior to the pandemic that are being hit the hardest now.
Okay. So one thing that I'm going to want to talk about with you in a few minutes are the areas of opportunity and learning that Congress could have had in fashioning this new bill and maybe didn't take up, specifically in terms of how the money is being distributed to Americans in the 50 states. So hold on to that idea here for a second, Professor Sullivan, because I want to sort of get back down to ground level here to get a sense as to what this surge in poverty in America really looks like. So we spoke to Alan Bloom. He's a communications officer for the Montgomery Area Food Bank, and his organization is seeing people in need every day.
You've probably seen the news reports where there's, you know, cars and cars and cars wrapped around. Well, we do that every single workday. Sometimes we do two, and most of the time we do what we call a double. A single is between 5 and 7 tons of food one place at one time. A double, obviously, is double that, so it's 10 to 14 tons of assistance delivered to families in need directly.
Bloom says that original CARES Act from this spring helped the Montgomery Area Food Bank in the short term, but he would also like to see organizations like his to be included in future government spending plans.
Boy, we were grateful. I mean, it really, really helped. But that was recouping losses and recouping expenditures. I'd much rather be proactive than reactive, and have our plans in place. I hope that there are a whole bunch of lessons learned. If we're going to count on food banks to carry the water and feed people, maybe we should fold them into the plan.
He also says, though, that no matter what, they're going to keep pace with the need for as long as it takes.
We had hungry Alabamians before this, so we're going to still do what we do, and that's we have a saying, feed hope across Alabama. We're gonna feed the hungry. That's what we do.
That's Alan Bloom. He's with the Montgomery Area Food Bank in Montgomery, Alabama. Well, joining us now from Goldsboro, North Carolina, is the Reverend William Barber. He's co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign and president and senior lecturer of Repairers of the Breach. Reverend Barber, welcome to On Point.
Glad to be on with you. Yeah. Glad that you're on point with this issue.
So tell us, are you feeling optimistic or about the stimulus package, or the, I should say, relief package that was just passed this week?
No, it's not a stimulus package. It's a stingy package. And I know everybody wants to put a spin on it and say it's a Christmas miracle. It's really a Christmas mess. It's starting to feel a lot like a Herod Christmas, not like a real Christmas. You know, Herod was the guy in the Bible that would destroy children and rather than do right by the people. And I think we got to, you know, it's actually getting to be bothersome when people, as my grandmother used to say, mess on the couch, and that's the nice way I'll say it, and then clean up a fourth of it and want you to congratulate them. You know, and then we talk about poverty and poor people. It often bothers me how people, it's not the poor talking. Mm-hmm. You know, people will say, well, this is good for poor. Let me tell you, we've been in conversation with people from Appalachia to Alabama. First of all, the shame of the reality is we act as though if before COVID was so great, there were 250,000 people more dying from poverty and low wealth before COVID. You know, my degree is in pastoral care and public policy. I do public theology and public policy. We had 43% of this nation was poor and low wealth before COVID. We're talking about 140 million people that were either below poverty or $400 away from economic disaster. The way we even measure poverty is wrong. I mean, we say 8 million people fell into poverty. We're using the government's 55-year-old poverty measurement, which was wrong when it was started, and it's bad now. So we don't even have the right numbers. And I was on the phone yesterday when we did an event with the White House last week, I mean the incoming White House, Biden administration. One young lady is a poor health worker. She lost 41 family members and friends in COVID. Another one was a white farmer who's talking about farmers who have committed suicide, many of them committing at a higher rate, didn't have insurance before COVID. The first thing we have to do is start talking about this right. And that is, before COVID, we had the fissures of poverty and racial disparity. We had 66 million white people living in poverty and low wealth, 26 million black people living in poverty and low wealth, 61% of all black people, 37% of all white people, 80 million plus people uninsured or uninsured. And then we have these politicians, Democrat or Republican, but now mostly Republican, who themselves get free health care paid for by the people, get all these big pensions, and they compromise on the backs of poor and low-wealth people.
Reverend Barbara, can I just jump in here for a second? Because the point that you're making is exactly right. There has been a long-term problem in this country, and that poverty number is just one way to capture it. The reason why today I keep talking about that 8 million additional Americans plunged into poverty in 2020 is simply because it just gives us an opportunity. It forces us to not look away this time, right? Because it's like you can make this nonpartisan judgment about how political decisions over the course of many months directly contributed to where 8 million more Americans find themselves today. Now, those same political decisions, similar ones, have been made for many years in this country, to your point exactly. But I felt like this time around, it's like, look, everything was brought into very sharp relief this year about things that were already going on.
Well, yeah, but and that's great. And that's why I say I'm glad you're doing it. But part of what we also have to do, you know, I come from a tradition, a theological tradition, for instance, in the book of Isaiah, it says, woe unto those who legislate evil and rob the poor of their rights and make women and children their prey. Even when we say 8 million more have fallen into poverty, most people walk around thinking we're talking about 30-some million in poverty before COVID. And they say 30 million or 40 million, like that's just a drop in the bucket. The problem is we have marginalized the impact. Mm-hmm. So even when we say 8 million have fallen into poverty, when billionaires have made almost $1 trillion, we're talking about 1 million people a month. And then we don't know if that's actually the number because it's using the old poverty measurements.
Yeah.
And then what we see is even with that, it took this Congress getting at the end of the year. And mainly McConnell deciding to do this now because of Georgia. And so what we're seeing in our campaign is, yes, all of this numbers and all of this death, even when we talk about the death in COVID, most of the death is poor and low-wealth people, regardless of their race, creed, and color. Yes, black people are 3-5 times more likely, but it's poor and low-wealth people. So what we're saying is, to deal with this, we've got to enact comprehensive, full, just COVID relief, long-term stimulus, sick leave, unemployment, protection from eviction, guarantee quality health care regardless of pre-existing condition.
Reverend Barber, stand by just for a second. I want to let you finish your thought, because we want to talk about what solutions need to look like, but I just got to take a quick break. So Reverend Barber and Professor James Sullivan, stand by. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are talking about the pandemic, about politics and poverty in America. And I'm joined today by James Sullivan. He's economics professor at the University of Notre Dame. He's put together something called the COVID-19 Poverty Dashboard. They're monitoring poverty and its increase in the United States in 2020. And the Reverend William Barber also joins us as well. He's co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign. And Reverend Barber, before the break, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you there.
That's okay.
But you were talking about the things that you think Congress does need to do to really make a meaningful difference to help people in need. Go ahead and finish your thoughts there.
Yeah, we met with the domestic policy team of coming in the Biden administration, Susan Rice and others, and we just met yesterday with the Congressional Progressive Caucus. And we said, listen, whatever they do tonight, we said it's inadequate. You know, certainly some people will get some help, but it's also like somebody being in the water and they need 20 feet of rope and you throw them 10 and then you pull that back halfway. What we have to have is an update, as I said, raise the minimum wage, immediately update poverty measure, get true measurements. We got to have free COVID testing, treatment, free vaccines. We need to be doing this, accessing this to the most vulnerable first. Then we need a national rent freeze, mortgage moratorium without credit penalties, increase food and programs like SNAP. And we've got resources to keep these rural hospitals and community health centers open, because we're not even talking about what's happening in Appalachia and what's happening on the reservations, or they shouldn't even call it that. And we've got to have federal infrastructure job programs that benefits jobs in low-income communities. And we're going to have to redirect some of the bloated Pentagon money to deal with these issues. Here's the only point we're trying to make. Is even before COVID, we live in a country where 54% of every discretionary dollar goes to the war economy and less than 16 cents goes to infrastructure, education, healthcare, and wages. We were already sitting at 43% of this nation in poverty and low wealth before COVID hit. Now we've had 8 million more people in less than 8 months, but that's using the old poverty measures, so we still don't know. We are in a moral and economic crisis. Then the good thing, as you said, is that maybe the fact that so many people are in poverty now that never thought they would be will shock this nation. I'm not hopeful of that yet, because what we've done, I'm only optimistic, but I'm hopeful that there is a movement building. And people are going to have to fight back. 55% of poor and low-wealth people voted for Biden and Harris. 6 million more poor people entered the electorate this year than did in 2016. people are beginning to stand up and say, America cannot exist like this. Pre-COVID was bad. And so the only thing I caution people is please don't say, let's get back, as though before COVID was some glorious place. And lastly, the 8 million figure, what's dangerous in that, and I heard what you said about at least people can talk, but also if we don't talk about that 8 million right, and if we suggest all we need to do is get back to the pre-8 million that have been added, we actually end up fooling ourselves and living in a form of political illusion and delusion that actually will disable our ability to have the kind of consciousness and policy changes that we need moving forward. That's the thing that we have to say. The Pope said it best a few weeks ago, and I'll stop here. He said, we have to come to a point that we stop offering people the magical solutions of neoliberalism and trickle down. He says those are magical formulas that don't work, and we have to deal with the issue of poverty and low wealth and how extensive it is in the wealthiest nation in the world.
Reverend William Barber, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, joining us from Goldsboro, North Carolina. I know I've got to let you go, Reverend Barber. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Take care now.
So, Professor Sullivan, let me turn back to you here, because I think what one of the many things that Reverend Barber points out is here is a year in which the United States, should it choose to do so, can confront some structural truths, okay? And I want to take some of them apart here for a second with you. For example, as we're talking about poverty, at the same time, you know, you'd mentioned employment before. Over the past couple of weeks, we still see the stock market touching those record highs. I mean, Dow 30,000. Isn't that part of that because as people are losing their jobs, even though their consumption might be going down, the companies that are the heavyweights on the stock market, the Amazons of the world, for example, are doing better than ever as small businesses get liquidated and as there are fewer people on the payroll for some of these businesses. I mean, it seems like that is just part of the system here. It's why we have what people are calling that K-shaped recovery.
That's right. I think one of the most unique, striking things about this current recession due to the pandemic is, one, how it's disparate in its impact, right? So there are, I'm hesitant to use the phrase "the winners" in this, but there are some, Amazon is a common example, but certain industries that have actually benefited economically from the pandemic. And then there are many others that have been hit really hard. So it's very disproportionate in its impact. And the other unique feature about the current economic situation is that we have a good sense of the cause, right? The cause is the pandemic. And we now are starting to see a light at the end of the tunnel for that cause, which means that we think that this is going to be fairly short-lived on the aggregate. And so what it really boils down to is who can weather the storm or not. And there are some groups and some businesses that can say, look, we think 6 months down the line, there's pent-up demand. We're going to be doing quite well. And that's reflected in the stock market. And then there's others, the tens of thousands of small businesses that have not been able to weather the storm and have gone under.
If I might just respectfully disagree with you on one thing, you've said a couple times the cause is the pandemic. I see it a little bit differently. I see the pandemic being the trigger, but the cause is how we've chosen to respond to the pandemic. Because have we seen the same sort of catastrophic unemployment and millions or high percentage of numbers of people being plunged into poverty in other countries as they too have responded to that same trigger of the pandemic?
So it's true that we saw this really sharp rise in unemployment, unprecedented on record. It was fairly short-lived. We've seen quite a bit of a rebound, and that can be tied really closely to businesses being affected by the pandemic. It's certainly fair to say that what's happened to poverty is not not alone. It's not singly driven by what's happening in the labor market, right? Because there was a way to at least temporarily offset that through government relief, and that has come in piecemeal. So it's true that in terms of maintaining economic well-being during this crisis, there are many factors at play. But in terms of getting the labor market back to where it needs to be, where it was before, where we were on a good trajectory and had historically low unemployment rates, we have to tackle the pandemic before we're going to be able to get back to that situation.
And that too requires comprehensive leadership. So I cannot help myself but to say that. Now, listen, I also wanted to ask you about, again, sort of taking apart the structural truths or examining the structural truths here that your very analysis about poverty is revealing. You know, in the summer, or earlier this year at least, we were hearing from some members of Congress, some Republican members of Congress, that, hey, you know, given the fact, and this is a true fact, that with the extended unemployment benefits and the stimulus that was sent out by Washington, that many Americans were actually, their incomes were higher than they were while they were working. And so some conclusions were drawn by some members of Congress that said, well, we're incentivizing people not to work. But isn't another conclusion that we ought to draw that people's wages were so low to begin with, what Reverend Barber was talking about, that just a little bit of additional stimulus from the federal government actually put them better off in the middle of the pandemic? I mean, what does that say about how this economy is working for folks?
And that's certainly the case that the ones for whom the benefits exceeded their pre-separation earnings were the very low wage workers, and that, to be clear, that was really only during the period where we had the supplemental unemployment insurance benefits that expired at the end of July. The way the typical unemployment insurance benefits work is you get about half of your pre-separation earnings. And it's also true, I think this is more to your point, is that we have considerable earnings and wage inequality in the United States. And so finding ways to structure our safety net to address that and to encourage growth in the labor market to address that rising inequality is certainly a challenge for policymakers.
Mm. Okay, so let's get back to one of the things that's in the current bill that just was passed by Congress that's very similar to what was in the CARES Act. I want to talk with you a little bit about the fact that the United States is still using unemployment insurance as the means to distribute the money. So let's hear for a moment from Dinesh Karki. Dinesh was laid off from his manufacturing job in Boulder, Colorado in September. Losing that income meant that he could no longer afford the house that his family had planned to buy in the fall. Instead, they're still living in their mobile home.
I'm only getting the $2,000 from the unemployment. So, the kids, two kids, mom and wife, me, all together as a five family, and have to pay land, rent, car insurance, car payment, and the medical expenses, food, groceries, all those things is hard to manage. But still, I'm managing very, very hardly.
And Dinesh says he has a message for Washington. He wants lawmakers to pay attention.
They need to know how the people surviving in this moment, right? And how many people losing job. I think they need to think about it like that.
That's Dinesh Karki in Boulder, Colorado. Now, Professor Sullivan, Dinesh said he's getting $2,000 from unemployment. And I know you've talked about this in your research, that one of the challenges right now that Americans are facing is that so much of the additional funding from Congress is coming through unemployment insurance, which is just administered in different ways in different states. And that actually has a direct relationship to where you're seeing spikes in poverty.
That's right. I like the idea of using the unemployment insurance system because it's targeting a group that is directly affected negatively by the pandemic, right? So those who've lost their jobs. it's a lot to ask the unemployment insurance system to handle, you know, more than 80 million claims, when they're used to you know, managing a couple hundred thousand a week. But there's a real challenge there, and what we've seen is large differences across states. So some states have done a really good job of processing claims and verifying eligibility and getting the benefits out to those that are eligible. Many other states have there are long delays. Those that are eligible are not getting the benefits that they're eligible for, and that can be really difficult when people are struggling to put food on the table. And what we're finding is the states that where the processing of unemployment insurance claims have been delayed or slowed, and those that are eligible aren't getting the benefits, we're seeing a sharper rise in poverty than those states that are more effective at getting those benefits to those that are eligible.
So we've just got a couple of minutes left here, Professor Sullivan, and just forgive me for being such a broken record on this, but your data shows us that decisions made in Washington, there's a one-to-one correlation practically with outcomes in Americans' actual lives. So with that in mind, that policy can either contribute to poverty or policy can alleviate poverty in America, depending on what we choose to do. If you had the opportunity to speak to members of Congress, to speak to the incoming Biden administration, what would you point to about what they ought to do, what your research is showing? What steps should they take next?
Yeah, so there are two really important takeaways from my perspective. In terms of designing a package that addresses the current issue, because I want to kind of separate that from the really important structural issues that we've talked about in absence of the pandemic or the recession. One point is the tremendous uncertainty that the pandemic and the recession has imposed on certain households. And we see that even though their incomes are rising because they get the stimulus payment, they're holding back, they're not spending money. It's evidence that they're really nervous about their economic prospects in the future. And one reason that happens is because we're uncertain about whether or not these government benefits will be extended beyond their current expiration deadlines. So one thing to offset that uncertainty would be to build in guarantees that if the economic situation is as bad in March or April as it is today, then we would agree to extend these benefits. And that's not there. And then given what we've seen, there's certainly justification in being anxious about whether or not the government will be able to extend those benefits. The other point I'd make is that there, back to this point about some people are being hit really hard by this current situation and others are not, is that we really want to target these resources to those that are in most need. Mm-hmm. Some of these stimulus payments are going to families with incomes upwards of $200,000. I'd rather target those to those that are struggling to put food on the table.
Those would be good first steps. And then we have those deeper issues that have been with us for years, as Reverend Barber had pointed out. Well, James Sullivan is an economics professor at the University of Notre Dame. He's put together with other researchers this COVID-19 poverty dashboard. Professor Sullivan, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to talk to you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.